Okay, good morning. In this talk, I want to briefly address a few basic questions. How does God become real for people? And how can they sustain that belief in an age of skepticism? So, a few introductory comments. The truth is, it really should be very difficult to believe in God. God is invisible. You cannot look at God in the eye or hear what God says with your ears. And yet people do believe in God, at least that's what they tell pollsters. According to the Gallup poll, roughly 95% of Americans say they believe in the existence of God or a higher power. And that percentage has remained steady since World War II. In a 2008 Pew study, two-thirds of Americans completely or mostly agreed with the idea that angels and demons are active in the world today. And nearly one-fifth said they receive a direct answer to a specific prayer request at least once a week. I don't know the data elsewhere. So these are fairly difficult, even improbable claims, even for believers. We live in pluralistic, fairly self-aware societies, and the commitment to faith is a choice in the faith of the in the fate of uncertainty, right? Human knowledge is limited. Many Jews have doubt and struggle at some point with the despair that this could all be a fantasy. Kierkegaard described the decision to believe as a leap in the dark, as a choice founded not on evidence, but on the way we choose to live in the face of inadequate evidence. But the importance of our decision, given that uncertainty, is why one can argue that no one is an adult until he or she has at least seriously considered the question of God. Not whether God exists, which is a fairly abstract and pretty meaningless question, but the problem of identifying God in ordinary life. Is God real? Does God speak to us? Can we speak to God, etc.? So I want to really offer some preliminary thoughts on this morning. It's not going to be any kind of complete answer, just things that I'm thinking about. In the parsha we read yesterday, Yaakov has a dream of a ladder resting on earth, with angels going up and down and God at the top of the ladder. And the Rambam, in source number 2, alludes to this dream in order to argue for the basic process of prophecy, where he talks about the idea in the guide of everyone who ascends does so climbing up this ladder, so that that person necessarily apprehends God who is upon it, as God is stably and permanently at the top of the ladder. So from this, you would think that Maimonides has a fairly accepting view of the idea that humans can speak to God and the reverse. But it turns out that he expresses enormous difficulty, even skepticism, about the potential of any divine-human relationship or communication in certain passages in the guide, and we'll take a look at a few. Here's one, source number 3. He writes in Guide 152, there's no relation in any respect between God and any of his creatures, for relation is always found between two things falling under the same species. If things fall under two different genera, there's no relation between them in any respect. And he gives examples. There's no relation between 100 cubits and the heat which is in pepper. Let's just pause there, right? So this is a fairly kind of almost scientific analysis of why divine-human communication is difficult. The Rambam is talking about the idea that there are things that are possible to analogize because they are the same type of thing, even if they are very, very different in terms of their quantity. So in other words, if somebody says, on the one hand, we talk about 1 inch, and on the other hand, we talk about 100 million light years. So those are very, very, very far apart, but they're on the same scale. There's a spectrum that can be compared. And the spectrum can be compared because we're talking about distance in the case of each of them. But if you were to say in just an ordinary English syntax, you were to compare, say, 100 kilometers to sourness or to sweetness, that would be a non sequitur. The sentence makes no sense. You can't compare distance to taste, right? And so on. So there's not just a grammatical problem, there's a philosophical problem. You can't compare things that have no analogous frame of reference. So when the Rambam here says in 152 of the guide that there's no relation between 100 cubits, 100 feet, and the heat which is in pepper, he's setting up an argument that says that, look, if something is so unlike another thing that there's no common frame of reference at all, there's nothing to actually analogize, so how much more so is it, he continues in this passage, with God and us. And he continues and says, because the latter belongs to the genus quality and the former to the genus quantity, right? Talking about distance and taste. There's no relation either between knowledge and sweetness, between clemency and bitterness. How then, he writes, could there subsist a relation between God and any of the things created by God, given the immense difference between them with regard to the true reality of their existence, than which there is no greater difference? You couldn't think of a greater difference than the difference between God and anything other than God. So that poses a very fundamental religious problem. Because if we're saying that there's no possibility of any kind of analogous relationship, then on what basis shall religion continue? And we're talking here about very practical, non-philosophical problems. To whom do I pray? What is the purpose of those prayers? What is the purpose of any language that I would use to address God? What is the purpose of any actions that I would do in front of God? Maimonides alludes to this a few chapters later in the guide, in source 4, when he says, glory then to God, who is such that when the intellects contemplate his essence, he's not just talking about humans here, but the heavenly spheres, their apprehension turns into incapacity. And when they contemplate the proceeding of his actions from his will, their knowledge turns into ignorance. And when the tongues aspire to magnify God by means of attributive qualifications, meaning you start saying nice things about God, like the 13 midot, and all sorts of fun praise words, all eloquence, he says, turns into weariness and incapacity. You're speaking rubbish, basically. The most apt phrase concerning this subject is the dictum occurring in Tehillim, silence is praise to you. So, in a real level, he's saying that all language is inadequate, and silence would be the best thing because it's the only thing that doesn't actually lie, because all the other words are, in a sense, lying. We have a bit of a problem here now. I don't know if this is a solvable problem. I'm certainly not going to solve it this morning, which is that there is a contradiction between the sort of philosophical purity that he wants to inject into the Jewish discussion, right? He does not want God treated like some sort of idolatrous object, like the guy in the sky with the gray beard and the lightning bolts. So clearly he wants Jews to begin to start thinking about God in a kind of grown-up way. Stop ascribing to God the idea that he's just sort of on Mount Olympus, like Zeus. Stop thinking that there's anything about God that in any way resembles anything about you. So there's a kind of purity in this stripping away of all of these attributes. The problem is that when you strip it away so well, when you do such a good job of purifying God philosophically, you leave a practical hole, a huge hole, in which Jews must come through and figure out how to actually operate. I'll take questions at the end. How to operate in a practical sense. Okay. Marvin Fox summarizes this very nicely in source number 5. Sorry, in source number 6. One more thought of Maimonides along the same lines in source 5. As for someone who thinks frequently and mentions God without knowledge, following a mere imagining or following a belief adopted because of his reliance on the authority of someone else, he does not in true reality mention or think about God. For that thing which is in his imagination and in his speech does not correspond to any being at all and has merely been invented by his imagination. If you think that you're really praying to God, when you come up with all these kind of images of God in your head, you're not. You're just praying to your own imagination. To which Marvin Fox summarizes, considering from the perspective of the philosophical doctrines of the guide, conventional prayer would seem to be a meaningless and even improper activity. Praise of God is impossible because we have neither the language nor the knowledge to speak about him in any meaningful way. The ideal praise of God may well be, as Maimonides suggests, wordless praise. But how can this ideal be realized in actual human lives? Our dependence on language is deep. We cannot conceptualize without language, although we are fully aware that our conceptions are defective and our language inaccurate with respect to God. A good paradox, right? All we have is language. That's all we've got. But language doesn't work. So what do you do in a situation where, in fact, that's all you've got, and yet it's not going to do the job? And that's the problem he leaves us with. And the truth is that Maimonides faithfully codifies, right, all the laws of prayer, even faithfully codifies all the laws of sacrifice, which he would seem to be rather dismissive of when you look at 332 of the guide. So it's not that he wants to lead you away from a traditional or practical Jewish life. He does what he needs to do in terms of telling us that this is what Judaism expects of us. But at the same time, he also sends a counter message that is somewhat undermining and even subversive of that ability to be faithful to the tradition by saying that on some philosophical level, this may be a fantasy. This philosophizing about God and this kind of purification of the divine image was annoying for Abraham Joshua Heschel, right, the 20th century philosopher who was born in 1907 and dies in 1972. Heschel, in a way, mines the other side of the terrain. Heschel is much more concerned with God being an active, involved, empathic presence in human life than worrying about whether this all makes philosophical sense. And you can see in a number of passages here from books that he wrote in the 1950s, that kind of sentiment. For instance, in Source 7, and it's clear that some of this is directed against Maimonides and Maimonides' conception of God in the Guide. When Heschel writes, "The God of the philosophers is all indifference, too sublime to possess a heart or to cast a glance at our world. Our goal is to ascertain the existence of a being to whom we may confess our sins, of a God who loves, of a God who is not above concern with our inquiry and search for him, a father, not an absolute." Right? So I think this is pretty plain, right? Heschel, in a way, saying, the God that I see in the God, that's not the God I want. That's not the God I think Judaism wants. That's not a God that I read about in the Bible, the God who is concerned with the oppressed and freeing the enslaved. So not only does this philosophical picture of God not match how Heschel reads the biblical text, but also obviously doesn't match what he would like to believe that God is, right? An empathic being who is intimately concerned with our everyday lives. The problem here then is a way that you have on both sides. The question you might ask is, if Maimonides is right, what's left of Judaism? And if Heschel is right, is it really true? In other words, is it a fantasy? Because just because we want something to be a certain way, or because we'd like to think about God in a certain way, doesn't necessarily translate into it being that way. So Heschel spends a lot of time in a very kind of sideways fashion, trying to intuit the idea that maybe there's some way that we can experience the presence of God in the world. And he uses a lot of words that are somewhat poetic, not exactly precise, but maybe this is not a domain of precision at all. Trying to somehow get us to feel that there are certain things we can do or certain experiences that we need to open ourselves out to in order to feel that very inchoate presence of God in the world. So the next number of sources will sort of show that attempt on his part, and I'm going to leave it to you to see how you feel about these things. Let's take a look at source number 8. He writes, "Our radical amazement responds to the mystery but does not produce it." Right there, he's telling you that there's a mystery that wasn't a human invention. It comes to us and we encounter it. We do not create the ineffable, we encounter it. Subjective is the manner, not the matter, of our perception of the larger world and the mystery beyond that. Right? So all these sentences trying to say that I didn't make this stuff up. There is something out there, right? As they say in the science fiction movies. there is something out there. You want to call it God, you want to call it a larger force, you want to call it a presence, you want to call it the mystery, whatever you want to call it, whatever language you'd like to apply to this. There's something out there. We didn't make it up. We're just kind of trying to respond to it, says Heschel. And what we perceive is objective in the sense of being independent of and corresponding to our perception. So that seems like a very important sentence. If we're going to use the word objectivity here in terms of metaphysics, which after Kant is a hard thing to do, he wants to say that it is there, it's not just something I'm perceiving. Our radical amazement responds to the mystery but does not produce it. You and I have not invented the grandeur of the sky, nor endowed man with the mystery of birth and death. We do not create the ineffable, we encounter it. Now, for me, there's something just a tiny bit, not just even a tiny bit, slippery about these sentences. I like Heschel, but I've always found him a very slippery thinker, and in some ways very unsatisfying in that way, because he sort of shifted the terms of the discourse here. You think he's talking about, at the beginning of the passage, there's a God, I didn't make him up, I'm just responding to him. But then he sort of drops down a level and says, well, you know, everybody has human experiences that are pretty awe-inspiring. The sky, the stars of the sky, the mystery of birth and death. All of these things could be mysterious, awe-inspiring, awesome, and have nothing to do with God, have nothing to do with metaphysics. So there's a little bit of a blurring of the line here. In Source 9, and much of the stuff comes from those two books, Man is Not Alone, Alone and God in Search of Man. In Source number 9, he says, awareness of the divine begins with wonder. That's a big Heschelian word. Wonder or radical amazement is a prerequisite for the authentic awareness of what is. So he's saying that there is something out there and you need to adopt a certain kind of lens, both visually and mentally, emotionally, in order to see it. Remember like when we were kids and there was this, they used to sell that cheap little red tape that you could put over words and you couldn't see them, and if you put the red tape over them, suddenly they would emerge, you know, or invisible ink. So it's almost like Heschel says, there's a thing out there, and if you don't put on these lens called wonder or radical amazement, you're not going to see it. Now, I'm going to get back to this a little bit later, but I know many people who find this a very objectionable argument, and I'm sort of semi among them, which is there's this idea that there's something out there and you just have to get it, right? People who talk about Kabbalah do that for me. They talk endlessly about all of these like sort of metaphysical schemes, and they talk about Sfirot, and they talk about this unifying with that, and they look at you as if this is some sort of objective reality, when in fact it's very much a kind of constructed system, and they make you feel like, how can't you see that? So Heschel, in a way, is calling the bluff on everybody, saying, you know, if you only had this business of wonder and radical amazement, you could really respond to what's out there. Prerequisite for the authentic awareness of what is. I'm not actually sure I know what that sentence means. Does he mean the authentic awareness of the idea of physical stuff? Like, if you really open your eyes and you think about the sky, the stars, the trees, the moon, or is he talking about metaphysical stuff? And the question then is, well, will wonder get me to metaphysical stuff? Let's say I'm radically amazed. Will God suddenly appear in my living room? Right? I don't know what he's saying exactly. I'm not saying he is or he isn't saying this stuff. But to me, the writing cheats just a little bit. In Source 9, he continues and says, what is more than what you see. Again, physical or metaphysical? Obviously, in the age prior to the telescope, there's a lot more than what you can see, and there's even a lot more than what you can see now. But I suspect he's talking about the metaphysical. What is far off and deep. Okay, I'll grant that. We are amazed at seeing anything, amazed not only at particular values and things, but of the unexpectedness of being as such, at the fact that there is being at all. So now he actually switches into existential language, right? The very notion that anything exists at all, that there is being, that there is life, right? And here he's drawing off the 20th century tradition of Heidegger and Husserl and Camus and all the rest, right? Aren't you amazed that you're even here at all? All right, but that was a real shift in the whole argument. Okay, I am amazed that I'm here at all. But still, is that sentence meant to imply, is the next sentence in the invisible bracket, so don't you understand that you're only here because of God? You know, as opposed to Darwin, etc. Right? He leaves these things sort of deliberately vague. To me, a very nice corrective here is from the Protestant thinker Peter Berger in Source 10. Berger, a much more understated approach, what we might call a kind of soft theology, in which he says, look, you know, nothing's really provable, but there are things that in human life may be hints at best, what he calls rumors, right? And he says it like this. For those of us who have not been visited by angels, transcendence, and that's a nice wry piece of humor there, transcendence can only be experienced in secondhand or fairly muted ways. I have long thought that the signals we find in ordinary everyday life are of decisive importance. The recurring urge of human beings to find meaningful order in the world, the redemptive experiences of play and humor, the ineradicable capacity to hope, the overwhelming conviction that certain deeds of inhumanity merit absolute condemnation, the sometimes searing experience of beauty, be it in nature or the works of men, and many others. Each of these, though quite ordinary in many cases, and almost never perceived as supernatural, points toward a reality that lies beyond the ordinary. He's not willing to say more than that. He's willing to say, you know, there's stuff that we experience in human life that just seems bigger than it is. Beauty, pain, humor, hope. These seem to point to something transcendent. It's not a proof for anything. It doesn't prove that there actually is something at the end of the rainbow, but in human life, that's what we use to suggest to ourselves that maybe there's a God. But it's very, very small. You can't overstate the claim based on these rumors of transcendence. And when Heschel tries to get down in Source 11 to the mechanics of how you would experience the metaphysical, he says something interesting. He says the following. Beyond our reasoning and beyond our believing, there is a preconceptual faculty that senses the presence of the divine. Ah, so now he's actually calling it what he wants to call it, saying we can sense God. But it's preconceptual. What does he mean by that? So we have to go back to that. We do not perceive it. Right? So this is not sensory. We have no knowledge, so this is not a mental state. We have only an awareness of something that can neither be conceptualized nor symbolized. Concepts are second thoughts. All right, let's stay on that sentence for a bit. Concepts are second thoughts. He seems to be saying that the way human beings, in his view, can experience the metaphysical, God, is from something that is not linguistic. It's pre-verbal. It's even pre-conceptual. By conceptual, we mean, and we've all had this experience. You have an experience of something, it's deep, it's mysterious, you then convert it into language, you convert it into an idea, and the reason you do that is so that you can communicate to another person, right? But as soon as you do that, the great paradox, right? It's like Zen, the harder you squeeze, the quicker it goes out. As soon as you do that, and you're trying to get the other person to understand what you're talking about, you've lost something. It doesn't quite communicate. Because the feeling you had, which is pre-verbal, once you conceptualize it, and you have to, right? Because nobody has a kind of radar inside of your heart. You have to convert it into something in order to get it across to them. But as soon as you do that, paradoxically, it's not the same thing you felt. So when he says that concepts are second thoughts, he means that you had something initially. Like if you've ever walked into a room and you had like a shudder. It wasn't even a piece of language or a piece of knowledge. It was just something that happened to you inside. It's that he calls the connection. It's that he calls the experience of God. But of course, as soon as you attempt in any way to form this into some sort of meaningful or structured idea, it's already gone. You're already past it. As he says, and we continue here in Source 11, the living encounter with reality takes place on a level that precedes conceptualization, on a level that is responsive, immediate, preconceptual, pre-symbolic. It's almost infantile, right? In the sense of it being prior to. And I think there is actually, I mean, I haven't really looked into it deeply, but I would be interested to see the sorts of connections you could make here with those people who've theorized about early child development, and especially in the sort of the infant stage, about the cognitions of the world that come prior to language, prior to symbolization, prior to conceptualization, just a kind of inchoate feeling. And he talks about this being actually the modus operandi of the prophets by saying that the prophets had no theory or idea of God. What they had was an understanding, an intuitive grasp of hidden meanings of an unspoken message. So in some ways, that's his real attempt there to form some kind of conceptualization of the non-conceptual, of saying that, well, this is the best we have, this is the way we do it. Now, partly what you have here, of course, is that when you look at this, the best you can say is that, oh, yeah, maybe I felt like that, but if you don't feel like that, in other words, if you're not converted, how is this going to speak to you? Because after all, we're talking about something that he's already confessed. You have no ability to objectify this in real language. It's not going to be the same as saying this is a cup of water. There's just no possibility that what you will feel in that preconceptual stage will necessarily be of any usefulness to anybody else. And in fact, there's a really nice analysis here by Rabbi Shai Held in his book on Heschel from a couple of years ago, where I think he's got it just spot on right. Let's read the analysis of Rabbi Held in Source 12. He says, one of the dangers of beginning with human experience is that perhaps one is always only talking about just that, human experience and nothing more. Like when you're saying, I believe in God, I believe in God, what you're really saying is, yes, I believe in God. And that's all you're saying. There's nothing there that is objective, and there's certainly nothing there, frankly, that should mean a thing to me. We often say these things in religious communities as if the statement, I believe in God, I'm sure God is real, should have actual meaning for the other person. But in essence, it shouldn't have any meaning at all, because all you're communicating is something that is totally subjective inside of you. And the best I can say is, that's wonderful. You know, or, that's great, good for you. But we actually cheat a little bit in religious communities when we say that. Because I think a lot of the time, especially in education, is a very unfortunate thing in education when you're attempting to take that further and you're saying, you know, for thousands of years, the Jewish people have believed in God, and the silent bracket is, so you, bored kid at the back of the room, you should too, right? And that's a non sequitur piece of thinking. So as Rabbi Held continues, human beings may sense or feel that they are interacting with something objectively real, but we must always be open to the idea that what we encounter is merely our own projection. Heschel's portrayal of how the religious person thinks is very moving, but as an argument for why the experience should be trusted by someone who has not had it, it avoids the question by reasserting a feeling. I can't tell you how many times in my life I have experienced that sentence. Somebody will say to you something they're convicted about. I think Hashem is everywhere. And you say, really? I haven't had that experience. How can't you have had that experience? Don't you see Hashem is everywhere? In other words, you're answering their question, but just intensifying your own subjectivity. You're just saying it louder and stronger, as if that somehow addresses the epistemological problem that other person is having. And that's what Rabbi Held points out. One cannot successfully respond to an epistemological challenge to an experience simply by reaffirming the intensity of the experience itself. You can't just keep repeating how real it is for you and think that that somehow translates, now it must be real for you because it's like real for me. The intensity of the experience is no guarantee of its truth. In the end, Heschel does not address that fact, that subjective experience, no matter how vigorous, will never be fully persuasive to one who is not on some level already persuaded. Right? So as usual in my religious life, I end up stuck. Because, you know, I have Maimonides' purity on the one hand, which is very satisfying philosophically and leaves me utterly bereft if I take it seriously as a dovener. And then I have Heschel's beautiful poetry in terms of preconceptual intuitions of God, which is lovely, but if you don't feel it, it just remains Heschel's experience. He might as well just be writing his autobiography as opposed to a piece of philosophy. But I like the dialectic. I like the dynamic between the two, and I like the thought of the answer somehow being in that warp and woof, that ebb and flow between them. And I think that's something that Rabbi Held in an interview gets out very nicely in Source 13. When he says that Heschel attacked the way Rambam talks about God, or maybe more to the point, makes talking about God impossible. Heschel agrees that theology has to emphasize God's otherness, but an exclusive focus on divine otherness, such that we can say nothing at all about who God is, leaves us without a God who can be said to care for the oppressed, and this for Heschel represents a complete abandonment of the God of the Bible. At the deepest level, there's no give and take. Heschel disputes the notion that you can arrive at a synthesis between scriptural covenantal religion on the one hand and abstract philosophical monotheism on the other. I often imagine Heschel and the Rambam exchanging barbs. The Rambam accuses Heschel of being an idolater. What do you mean, God cares? And Heschel retorts that Rambam flirts with atheism. For the Rambam, the enemy was idolatry, and just as Moses shattered external idols, the Rambam will shatter internal pictures of God we have in our mind. For Heschel, in contrast, the enemy is indifference, the disregard of other people's pain and suffering. I think the question about Heschel's God, the God who's outraged and wounded by every act of oppression by the strong against the weak, is not whether it's Jewishly defensible, but whether it's metaphysically believable in this day and age. I think he's got that right too. So there's no really easy solution here, because Judaism seems to be struggling often with this kind of dialectic between what may be purely true and what may be useful or efficient or inspiring in terms of a religious life. And I think we go through that sort of dialectic all the time. What I am struck by, and I'll just go for a few more minutes, I'm happy to take questions after that, is my experience in many years in university of teaching diverse populaces, including Christians. One of the things that I was always made an impact on me is when my Christian students would say to me that they have no idea how Jews can think about God in the way they think about God, this kind of invisible abstraction. I'll use an analogy from my real love, which is blues and rock and roll. So, I don't expect many of you to know this, but anyway. So I'm a big fan of ZZ Top. I know there are not a lot of ZZ Top fans in the room, but. So, the lead guitarist of ZZ Top, a man named Billy Gibbons, when he was young, he's in his 60s now. When he was a young man, he shared a dressing room with B.B. King. And he looked at B.B. King's guitar, and if you play electric guitar, you know there's a certain gauge of string, and the lighter the string is, the easier it is to bend. So B.B. King picked up Billy Gibbons' guitar, felt the strings, and said to him, "There's one thing I gotta ask you, boy. Why are you working so hard?" Right? Because his strings were heavy, and he thought, like, you should make your strings lighter so you can bend them, and actually that's what happened. That is exactly how my Christian students think about Jews. Why are you working so hard? Why do you make this God who you're supposed to be in contact with and connection with, and who's supposed to be in contact and connection with you, so invisible, so distant, so pure, so inaccessible, so stripped down, that he's not even there at all? We, of course, have all sorts of very substantive and well-made and already in place reasons for an answer because God can't be a person and that's idolatrous and any image of God is idolatrous and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But at the end of the day, in terms of actual Jewish living, I've always found it very fascinating their ability to access a God, and you, of course you can argue it's a God of their own invention, but nonetheless, the experience they have seems much more visceral. I grant you that there are, you know, obviously movements in Judaism. There are, you know, where I live in Jerusalem, there's all sorts of people with like sort of neo-Hasidic revivals and Bratzlovers and Habakkuks and all the rest. But still, the visceral experience of Jesus being my friend and being available and being there to answer my prayer in very specific ways is not something that Jews share. So I was very interested to read a book, actually made a big impression on me, by the Stanford anthropologist Tanya Luhrmann, called When God Talks Back. And when God talks back, Professor Luhrmann talks about the field work she did among evangelical Christians in California in a church called The Vineyard, in which they talked in very easy, non-self-conscious, non-embarrassed, guileless terms about the fact that God talks to them on a regular, daily, if not weekly, basis. And I know that the knee-jerk sort of reaction of Jews, you know, especially cerebral, intellectualized Jews, is, you know, this is silly and it's infantile and it's to be mocked and we're derisive about it. But I was very moved by it. I don't know that, and to be quite honest, I was quite envious of it. Because I certainly have not had experiences like they've had. And of course, the skeptical part of me can easily dismiss it by saying, of course you haven't experiences like that because they're fictitious. But I wasn't willing to do that. I wanted to read the book on their own terms, on what they were presenting. So I just want you to take a brief look, and then I'll answer any questions you've got, at a piece from Professor Luhrmann's book, which is source 17 here. Does God Talk Back? Right, so here, and my introduction came from the book, right? Here you see stuff that she says in the introduction and the first three paragraphs here. So I want us to turn, however, to the next page. The deep puzzle of faith is not why someone should believe in God. The puzzle is how sensible, reasonable people living in more or less the same evidential world as the skeptic are able to experience themselves as having good evidence for the presence of a powerful, invisible being who has a demonstrable effect on their lives and are able to sustain a belief in that presence despite their inevitable doubts. Right? This was a very powerful experience for her, right? She's sitting right next to this evangelical. Like, I'm human, you're human. I eat bread, you eat bread. You know, I watch movies, you watch movies. How is it that we're inhabiting the same space on Earth and you seem to have this completely other experience of the most fundamental thing in life than I do? How does that work? We both grew up in the 20th, 21st centuries. We both have been privy to all of the sort of skepticism, both pre and postmodern, that makes us feel like this kind of thing is yesteryear. And yet you believe, and they do, I mean, I don't have time here to relate the vignettes in the book, but they believe that God is speaking to them, and not just about like big things like heal my mother from cancer, but just everyday things like you're gonna be okay today for that meeting, or you know, just calm down because everything's gonna be okay, or don't take that exit on the freeway, take the next one, right? Like really down to the most sort of mundane level. And the theology here is very simple. If you have a religion and you have a God, and the idea of the religion is that God should be in touch with you and you with him, why would you construct a religion that makes that virtually impossible? What's the sense in that? Isn't religion about the very notion that God would make himself available, right? And I think it's very important for Jews when they think about Christians to realize that that underlies so much of what's going on in the religion. God makes himself available, so available that he will die for you, so available that he will talk to you, because otherwise, what's the point, right? I mean, if you go through English literature, which is what my doctorate is in, you see that there's, in the Romantic period, quite a bit of discussion in fictional form about this very point. And probably the apex of it is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is a brilliant novel, right, which is only thought about in Western culture in terms of, you know, kind of Boris Karloff and big pictures of Frankenstein. But the idea of it is very deep, which is that a being is made and then a being is abandoned. Right? That Victor Frankenstein, the scientist, creates a monster and then abandons it. And the novel traces the sort of painful process of what happens with the abandonment of the monster, which is obviously Shelley's allegory about human beings on Earth. So in some level, what these people in this book are getting at, it goes far beyond even Heschel. I mean, not only is Maimonides odd for them, Heschel's also odd for them. Right? I'm trying to point out here that there's even a spectrum here to belief. I may be skeptical about Heschel's very tentative approach to connection to God, and for Christians, that's already long, long in the rearview mirror. This is like, why are you doing this? Why are you constructing a system where God is so distant and so absent? Now, the question of how God becomes real for people, I leave you to the book to read, but I think that it's incumbent on Jews to think about these problems in a way which comes home to their actual religious life, how we construct our prayer services, whether the liturgy speaks to us as or is endlessly repetitive and irrelevant, whether we create environments that can allow for this kind of preconceptual apprehension of God, and so on. These are all for minds much bigger than mine. I'm happy to take questions. Yeah. Go on, bring it over.
If possible, for the recording.
For Maimonides. Wait till you're in the mic.
Yeah, for Maimonides, Christianity, most of Judaism is anthropocentric. You put man at the center, and that's what, of course, all the Christians are doing here. God is telling you, you know, what's stopped to get off on the freeway. And that's very nice, but fundamentally wrong and a lower form of worship. The point of Judaism, at least for Maimonides, is to place God at the center, and you do that not through imagination, but through intellect. Just one other brief point. I think you overstated Maimonides' stripping God of attributes. If you look at that chapter carefully, you can't speak about God's essential attributes. You can speak, as he says explicitly, about God's actions, whatever that means. And you also could speak about negative attributes. So there may be more room in Maimonides to speak about God, which then may leave more room for prayer than would appear from the particular excerpts that you cited.
I'm familiar with what you cite. It doesn't satisfy me at all. In 154, he talks about attributes, and he talks about the via negativa, and I'm not praying to a via negativa. I'm speaking here about how this all trickles down on a practical level to Jews who actually want to have a little bit more than this kind of really parsimonious experience of faith. But anyway, we'll keep going. Okay.
Thank you. Very interesting. I'm just, as you were talking about Heschel, I kept thinking of how that would be so different than Spinoza's deism and this sort of vague construct that we're supposed to subjectively feel. And from that, then, how does Heschel arrive at ethics, is my question.
Well, let's start with the first one first. For Spinoza, God is not out there because there's no there, right? God is in everything, and there's no independent entity. There's nothing you're getting in contact with.
It's a deism.
There's no sense of any kind of relationship, right? So that, in a sense, ends the matter completely. Heschel is actually talking about an old-fashioned out there, and he's talking about this very delicate house of cards. Like, if you just put one card too many, the whole thing collapses. So he's trying to construct an apparatus that would allow a person to sense the presence of the divine and not put too many cards down. So he's very tentative in terms of talking about it's preconceptual and it's, you know, pre-verbal and so on. But it does seem clear, he does seem to be trying to state the case that there is a being out there called the God of the Bible, and that God has infinite concern for human beings. And if you want to be in touch with that God, even on the most rudimentary level, then you have to open yourself up to what he calls wonder or radical amazement. You have to be in touch with these kinds of very primordial intuitions inside of you. And he doesn't really conclude the discussion. In other words, that's about as good as it gets, and maybe you'll have it. And Rabbi Helt's, you know, critique was simply that you can do all that and it can be utterly unpersuasive to the next person.
And can't create a model of ethics between people.
I mean,
ethical behavior.
You still have to believe, well, you either can construct a model of ethics on a hypothesis or on a reality. In other words, that's Levinasian, right? When you're talking about the idea that you experience the other. So look, if the other is really another, then you can translate it into human terms. But if God is a fiction, so you're just using it as a very convenient, you know, straw man to say be nice to the next guy.
If Maimonides doesn't, see, from what you're saying, seem to accept a personal God who stays engaged in our life, then how does Maimonides, or maybe modern-day Judaism, explain the Bible?
Yeah, in some ways, that's a great question. I think in some ways the Bible is enemy number one for Maimonides, because he has to spend an enormous amount of time. He has to do two things. I mean, the easier one is the thing he does in book one of the guide, where he's reinterpreting all language as figurative that would suggest that God is literal. So he reinterprets, you know, the old favorites. God walks and talks and gets angry and jealous. So he basically destroys the notion that any of that would be literal. The harder problem is the fact that, in fact, what he's really doing is he's substituting one kind of anthropomorphism for another. He never gets around the problem that any time you're going to talk about God, it's always going to be kind of as if, as it were, because you can never really describe this thing. And he's left with the paradox in a way of saying, well, it's never literal. You're never really talking to God as God, but there still is a God, and you're still praying. And it's almost a leap of faith, right? Because you're doing this thing called praying, and God is doing this thing called being God. And in a way, the issue is, how are the two twains meeting? And it's not entirely clear. And there's obviously a very long discussion in the guide about prophecy, about the Aristotelian system of the intellect, and so on. But the bottom line, I'm trying to speak here on a very basic level, is that it's not at all clear how the two ends meet up in the end. He's just asking you to do what you need to do as a Jew. He's also addressing the philosopher and telling the philosopher, look, don't think that God is really like we really think it is. And he's trying to hope that you can live with this kind of split-screen Judaism forever, where you acknowledge that God may be out of reach, but you still have this mitzvah to do what you're supposed to do.
On the point of the evangelical Christians, first of all, I'm not sure that it's only evangelical Christians who actually have an experience of God in their lives. And maybe in order to actually have those experiences, you have to be open to them, which means that you need to consider the possibility that the God of the Bible is true. And then you can experience it. So, you know, you have to be open to it. So Maimonides in some way is even blocking off that possibility of recognizing the presence of God in one's life.
I think that you're right. There are many people who are open to it. It isn't just evangelical Christians, but as a community, in other words, as a theology and a stance of a community, Christians are far more organized around this than Jews ever were and seemingly ever will be. I just want to address, lastly, the question of openness. There is a fundamental paradox about the idea of being open to things that are not provable, that are far beyond the physical, which is that as soon as you talk about it in the way Heschel does, somebody can come along from the other side and say, sounds to me like Judaism is the same thing as Scientology. Sounds to me that Judaism is the same thing as weirdo cults, because they're actually not arguing anything different. There's this thing out there that nobody's ever seen and nobody ever will see that's asking you to do all sorts of weird stuff. Some of it may be misogynistic and some of it may be pre-modern and some of it may be offensive, but do it anyway. You know, Jews love to answer this point by saying, yeah, but we don't do that stuff. You know, we don't kill rebellious children and wipe out Amalekites and have slaves and concubines and 50 shekel fines for rapists and so on. But that answer, of course, is disingenuous, because what it's saying is that human beings were able to, through their own ingenuity, work around the metaphysical problem by saying, I don't care if this comes from God, but we're not living this way on earth. So at that point, what you've done is you've constructed a very nice human system, which is lovely, and we all like living that way, but you haven't addressed the problem of why you would pay any attention to this invisible being when we're skeptical and mocking about all sorts of other ways of life that seem to us completely ludicrous, right? Christianity is ludicrous, and Scientology is ludicrous, and this is ludicrous, and that is ludicrous, but we, of course, we got the goods. So I think it's just worth thinking about. I'm always aware of the fact that somebody who's standing outside of the position I'm standing in can look at what I think and say, that seems nuts to me. I think what we like to do is we've confused the fact that we believe benignly for believing truly. In other words, my belief system, hopefully, for the rest of my life and up till this point, has not led me to do terrible things. So it's very nice. You believe in God. You want to wave a palm branch. You want to sit in a hut. You want to eat unleavened bread. You want to put on black boxes. Good for you. I have no problem with that. Just don't do anything that bugs me. And what we do with that is we convert that into truth, right? My problem with Islam is not what they said. It's what they do with what they said. There's plenty of passages in the Bible that are horrific to me, as horrific as what I see in the Quran. Judaism moved past it, evolved, did stuff with it. And so we have this benign religion most of the time. And we can say to ourselves, our belief is nice because we don't do bad things with it. That may be true, but it doesn't prove a thing. It doesn't say that there's any metaphysical basis at all for it. It just means that we have maturely been able to convert a metaphysical origin into a working and nice human religion. And God bless, that's exactly what I want, but it doesn't say a thing about truth claims. Anyway, thank you very much.